chaotic down here on the finish line in Vittel, as it always is, particularly when there's been a crash in the closing kilometre, and there were two crashes today. The first one on a tricky left-hand bend, which took down a lot of riders, and then the second one, which happened just before the line, really, a really hard impact for Mark Cavendish. He came off worse in that one, and I've just seen him go past several minutes after the bunch hit the line, and his hand is already bandaged up and strapped in netting, and blood seeping through the bandages. He was holding his right hand not on the handlebars, he was holding it, which may indicate, you know, he's damaged his shoulder or collarbone, but certainly his hand is in a bad way, and he looked very uncomfortable, as you'd expect. And the contrasting emotions of the Tour de France was that just as Cavendish was passing in one direction, Arnaud Démare in his French champion's jersey was passing in the other direction, going down to the podium, surrounded by his team helpers and a few gendarmes and Tour officials. And so things are just starting to calm down here now, and I'm waiting for the man of the day, Guillaume Van Kiersbroeck of Wanty Groupe Gobert, because he was out on his own for a couple of hundred kilometres. He's yet to finish. I'm going to wait and see if I can grab a word with him when he crosses the line.
Keep a good tempo. Some riders will come from the back to you, but I don't see anybody, and I was the whole day alone.
The gap went up very quickly, so you must have known from that moment you were in for a long day.
Yeah, I didn't expect, but it was a hard day. It was also tailwind and sidewind all day. It was a lot of wind sometimes, and if you're alone, you can never rest, and it was really hard.
Would you normally do a training ride that long on your own?
Alone, no. Most of all with some friends, and Jens Keukler is a good trainings mate of me, and if you train, it's sometimes long, but never so long like today and so hard.
What did you think about during the stage? You must have had time to think all sorts of things.
Well, yeah, I enjoyed a little bit the views and the people around the circuit. It was really really nice.
And this evening, hopefully your teammates will get you a beer?
Yeah, a few.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Tour de France in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we are in Vittel.
Bonsoir à tous et à toutes. Je vais faire une seule. Vous me permettez, s'il vous plaît? So I will do only this communication. We will not answer questions immediately because we have some other issues to deal with after my communication. So we decided to disqualify Peter Sagan from Tour de France 2017 as he endangered some of his colleagues seriously in the final meters of a sprint which happened in Vittel. We will apply Article 12.104, which is the disciplinary rules of the UCI, Article 11, which says irregular sprint, in which case we are allowed, the commissaires can decide to make higher, to enforce a judgment to disqualify the rider. Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much.
We were played in there by a variety of sounds from today's stage and a lot of talking points. So finally, we heard there from Philippe Marin, the head of the UCI jury, the chief commissaire of the race, who marched into the press room with a scrum around him and up to the front of the press room and delivered this unexpected verdict that Peter Sagan has been thrown out of the 2017 Tour de France for elbowing Mark Cavendish in the finishing straight and knocking Cavendish off. And I think that's a surprise, isn't it, Lionel?
Well, it's certainly a severe penalty, isn't it? Whether it's a surprise or not is up for debate. We're going to debate that in this episode of the Cycling Podcast.
Very, very rarely. I mean, Mark Renshaw headbutted Julian Dean in 2010 at the Tour de France and was sent home. Dean on that occasion didn't actually fall off. And Renshaw wasn't Peter Sagan. And I think that the point here is that Peter Sagan is the world champion. He won the stage yesterday. He pretty much wears the green jersey every year at the Tour de France. That competition obviously wide open now. We should mention the stage winner, Arnaud Démare, who is possibly a favourite for that jersey. Anyway, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Francois Thomazeau.
Hi there.
And Lionel Burney.
We're doing this podcast backwards, Rich, tonight, yeah. Aren't we? Well, let's put everybody in the picture and explain what happened very briefly on stage four from Mondorf-les-Bains to Vittel. 207.5 kilometres, and really we were treated to 200 kilometres of not very much at all. And then incredible drama in the last 1,500 metres. The man of the day in athletic terms really was Guillaume Van Kiersbroek of the Wanty Groupe Gobert team, who attacked right at the start, as we heard, hoping to entice a few other riders across to form a breakaway, but he was left to do it on his own, and he had a lead of around 13 minutes at one stage, so he knew he was going to be out there all day. He was finally brought in with 16.5 kilometres to go, a real 1980s type of stage it felt like today. There was no furious chase led by one or two teams, there was no big lead out, there was a technical tricky little finish as which we drove through earlier on this afternoon, and more than one person said to me in the press room, that final corner looks like a dangerous one, and it turned out to be, because that was where there was the first crash. A few of the GC riders came down in that, including Geraint Thomas, we believe. But the second one involving Mark Cavendish and Peter Sagan, which we will discuss in depth in this episode, was not just dramatic, but you know, a really nasty one to see. What we know is that Sagan apologised to Cavendish. We know Cavendish has been to hospital for x-rays after talking to the media, and we now know that Sagan has been disqualified from the Tour. Let's not forget the stage winner, Arnaud Démare, the French champion. He won his first Tour de France stage, and he's taken the green jersey from Marcel Kittel. Démare beat Alexander Kristoff, André Greipel and Nasser Bouhanni, who was hoping to win a stage near his hometown of Épinal. Overall, Geraint Thomas is still in yellow. Nate Brown is still in the King of the Mountain jersey, and Pierre Latour is still in white. And tomorrow, the race proper starts with the climb to La Planche des Belles Filles. But what drama today, Rich?
What drama? And overlooked in all this was the slightly dubious manoeuvres by Arnaud Démare in the finish as well. No stranger to controversy, Arnaud Démare, winner of Milan-San Remo last year, of course. But he first of all, he got a push from Garnieri, I believe, his lead-out man.
I don't think so, because Garnieri was involved in a crash. So
who was that then?
It couldn't be Michael Delage either, because he's injured. So I don't know what was that. Actually, Garnieri is normally his lead-out man, but he was involved in the first crash. So I mean, I didn't see the push, but I really don't know what
how
it
convenient,
was.
Convenient, eh? Yeah, well, a Frenchman, a resident Frenchman.
Well, you know why? Because I was standing at the FDG bus, expecting Marc Madiot to you know start one of his jubilation crises, which he did actually. You know, he went into a frenzy. So actually, I wanted to watch the finale, but since the TV on the bus was quicker than my phone, Madiou was already jumping around when I got to see the finish on my telephone. So I can't have an opinion
he got a push
on
which
this,
which is illegal. And then he also cut up Bouhanni
quite
badly.
Definitely right. Well, he cut. It's always tricky, you know. In these cases, let's imagine that Peter Sagan would not, you know, lift his elbow the way he did it, and had just moved a little bit to the right. Then you would have Sagan and Cavendish out of the Tour de France, not by the commissaires, but by the local hospital. It's tricky to say. It's been lots of irregularities in this sprint for sure, but is it up to us to decide, you know, whether it, you know, I mean, the commissaire made the decision, and there we are.
Well, it's not for us to apportion blame. That's already been done, basically. I mean, the jury has decided. Initially, Sagan was relegated to the back of the group, and so, you know, denied his group points towards the green jersey and penalised 30 seconds, which in the grand scheme of things probably wouldn't have made much difference. But Team Dimension Data, well, Rolf Aldag and Roger Hammond both headed straight down to the little hut where the jury from the UCI would be watching the incident. and they must have made their case in pretty strong terms.
Yeah, Mark Surgeon from Lotto Soudal as well came down to the permanence to stress the same points, because Greipel obviously has a saying that. So yeah, I suppose that the first decision was quite lenient, maybe too lenient on Sagan because of his status, and the second one was in my opinion, maybe Roger Hammond and Ralph Aldag realizing that Cavendish was probably out of the tour because, I mean, given the state of his collarbone and shoulder, I really can't see Cavendish starting the race tomorrow. They thought there was kind of double standards. One man is out of the tour, and another one is penalized 30 seconds. In the grand scheme of things, it's a little bit unfair.
Did you not hear Francois a different view at Francis de Jure about the incident and the view that Cavendish was actually at fault?
Yeah, because it's always, of course, the gesture, the elbow sticking out is spectacular, especially on TV, and you want to shout for murder. But in the same time, did really Cav had to be where he was? Did he ever? Did he really have a chance to overtake Sagan where he was between the fence and the world champion? If Sagan had done the instinctive thing he should have done, which is go a little bit to the right, once again, both of them would be in the fences. A couple of spectators would be involved as well.
Well, emotions were running high at the finish, and we were running everywhere at the finish. Well, certainly Francois and I were. Richard, you were on your Brompton, buzzing around. let's just hear first from Doug Ryder, the boss of Team Dimension Data, and Roger Hammond, one of their sports directors. This was their, emotions were running high, but this was their reaction right at the, as soon as they were speaking to the media.
Oh, I mean, it was terrible. It looked like he was, coming on the outside, and, I mean, Sagan knew he was there, and then, I mean, it was ridiculous. So, I mean, that wasn't racing like it should be. You know, when at that speed, there's instincts that happen. So I don't think anybody does something deliberately, but still, it happened, and I don't think it's right. But, there was headbutting in the past that happened to one of our riders that got thrown out of a race completely, not out of the stage. So I just think it's unnecessary. I mean, I don't know. They need to have a look at it really seriously, and some people seem to get away with things and others, I don't know, we'll have to see what the jury decides. It's their decision. We've seen it all at high speed, not really that slowly, and they need to look at it and get the views from everybody, and then I wasn't there, so they need to make that call. But what happened wasn't right, and so to be just disqualified for the stage, of course that affects him, in terms of his race, but it doesn't help us in terms of our race and in terms of Mark and his career. And he's a legend in the sport. So, it's really, really, really disappointing. His shoulder does not look good, so we'll have to wait and see, and we can only hope. But he's a tough guy because that was a hard crash. But we can only hope. But I'm not sure.
I really don't know. That's. I wish it was my decision, but it's not. So. I guess you guys should all go to the UCI commissaires and ask them that question themselves. I think that's speculative because it's not my decision. I also am very acutely aware that I'm biased in this situation. You know what? My heart has just gone from my throat down to my feet.
Well, Roger Hammond there saying that he's a biased observer because it's his rider who is in the hospital. But looking at it once, it looked like just a racing crash where Mark Cavendish came up the inside, and the gap that might have been there, and perhaps Cavendish is used to the door opening a little bit for him in those situations, suddenly that gap was not there. And of course, with the way the barriers go, they do lean out slightly because it's safer. They're covered so the feet don't stick out, because we've seen so many crashes in the past where people have hit the feet. They've been covered for many years now, but of course that gives the upper body more room than the feet and the wheels of the bike, and so that gap really was almost sort of triangle shaped, and Cavendish was trying to come up from behind. It's very harsh to blame the crash on Mark Cavendish, I think, but all of these incidents are six of one, half a dozen of another, really.
I agree. I find it amazing how people can be so convinced that they know exactly what's gone in a situation like that. At 45 miles an hour, you're not making rational decisions at that speed. You're acting on instinct. I don't believe for a second that Sagan set out to deliberately cause Cavendish to crash. he may well have been protecting his handlebars, because if a rider makes contact with his handlebars, he will fall off. And so I think it might have been over slightly aggressive by Sagan, but I don't believe he was... it reminds me a bit of an incident at the Olympic Games in Rio in the Omnium, where Cavendish caused a crash by sweeping down the banking and colliding with a rider. Again, I don't believe that people on Twitter were convinced that that was a malicious act. I don't believe that. I believe it's a mistake. And we don't know what the riders are seeing in that situation.
No, the problem is that's... TV probably changes the perspective, including of commissaires themselves. I'm sure at first sight that they might... Well, obviously it was a contentious sprint, but the way that elbow, you know, stuck out all of a sudden, and you can see it repeatedly, like it was not only deliberate, but maybe a reflex, you know. But it was spectacular from certain angles. And when Mark Cavendish talked about it, that, you know, when he left the bus in the midst of an unbelievable media scrum, that's what he said. He insisted many times the elbow. He wanted to talk to Sagan about the elbow, and actually that's the main thing, you know. Everything else was very, very almost illegal and very very hard fought, but all of a sudden maybe that little element of the elbow sticking out, it's just changed everything.
I think the thing is, when these sprints, you know, everybody is, you know, the pace is so high, the reaction times are immediate, you know, then it's not even time to think about what they're doing. And the other thing is that these sprinters, they're at the same time being aggressive and defensive. They're being aggressive to try and get ahead of everybody else, and they're being defensive of their space. That's on the road. And so, you know, having all of these forces pushing and pulling together, and it can't be overlooked that the whole group moved across the road from their left to their right, mm-hmm. closing up that space all the time on the right-hand side and making it hard for anyone wanting to go that way. And that's all part of the game as well, isn't it? Damar, he's got his half a bike length ahead of somebody else, or half a wheel ahead of somebody else, and can, once he's got into the, you know, the fast lane, if you like, he's then allowed to move over a little bit. Your phrase earlier, Rich, was, I think you said, Sagan had right of way there, really. He's at the front, and the rider behind has to moderate the way he moves based on the riders that are in front of him. Obviously, notwithstanding the rules about not switching, but, you know, drifting is okay, mm-hmm. switching is not. There wasn't a switch on by any of the riders on that sprint, but there was a definite drift, and that's what
there
kind of caused the problem.
A slight switch, we'll say. But in the same time, if Sagan apologized, it's not his style to apologize. That probably is aware that he did something wrong, and probably at the very moment when you know, he uses his elbow as a kind of protection or weapon, whichever way you see it.
I think we can say he did something wrong without apportioning blame, exactly. Without saying it was malicious.
I think he was aware that he was doing something wrong. And if you do something wrong, even if it's unintentional, you were mentioning Mark Renshaw. I mean, headbutting is obviously intentional. Yeah. But this was, you know, is it intentional, not intentional? In any case, it's wrong.
And Cavendish has been accused as well, of course. Remember 2013, Tom Wheeler's a sprint finish up in Brittany. And, you know, that gap that he was trying to squeeze through today was very similar to the gap he squeezed through in Copenhagen in 2011 when he won the world title. And it was Matt Goss, I think, at the front, who did just open the door, because your instinct when somebody's coming up like that can be just to drift a bit to let them through, or as we saw today with Peter Sagan, it can be to close it. And you know, it's that instinct that makes Sagan the great rider that he is, let's not forget. I mean, that is what these guys all have and what they need. And so I think, yeah. Oh, hang on, look who it is.
Well, I've just seen Mark Cavendish come out of the X-ray truck. He's going to another hospital. And when people will listen to this, of course, they'll know whether he's broken anything. And he's going to continue. Sagan, you want my opinion on Sagan? Well, I've only seen it a couple of times. It looked pretty naughty, didn't it? It reminded me a bit of one of your countrymen, Rich, Duncan Ferguson. Have you had many football? Have you had many football analogies on the podcast in the last few days?
Well, you should know. You've been listening.
I have, occasionally, intermittently. I think... And Cavendish said that he was confused, and I'm a bit confused by where that elbow came from, why he stuck it out at that point. But then I've also heard, and not really examined the footage, that what Demar did in the sprint, cutting across Buhani, was almost as bad. And, you know, Rolf Aldag, the Dimension Data Direct Sportive, is a guy whose judgment is generally pretty sound, and he was adamant straight away that Sagan should be kicked out, and it was very similar to what Renshaw did in 2010, certainly in terms of how dangerous it was.
Hi, I'm Michael. I'm the General Manager in Rafa Clubhouse Copenhagen, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yes!
That whooping that we heard there was the familiar reaction to a victory from Marc Madiot, and you were there to capture that, I think, Francois.
Yeah, I don't know the instinct you were talking about, instinct. Well, we journalists also have our instincts, and I decided to go to the FDG.
You didn't elbow anyone on the way, I hope.
Well, I might, actually. In a media scrum, I probably did. But my instinct was to go to the FDG bus, and it was the very last one on the line, so it was a long way. And it's funny, because I came there, I was on my own, and all of a sudden I saw Marc Madiot going out. He went for a pee, to tell you the truth, and he came back.
Great detail.
He came back and told me, what are you doing here? I said, well, you know, I usually have the right instincts. And he told me, I hope you're right. And he went back into the bus, and then all of a sudden a couple more journalists had come, and there comes Madiot back, rushing off the bus, screaming as usual. You know, and it was usual Madiot. I mean, for Madiot, it was very important. He took Arnaud Démare under his helm. We know that Madiot is not really a Tour de France fan. He likes classics. He likes sprinters. That's the kind of riders he likes. And he actually, when he had to make the choice at one stage in their career between Nasser Bouhanni, who was in the same band, and Arnaud Démare, he didn't hesitate at all. He kept Arnaud Démare. And this year, you know, they really built a train. I mean, Fred Grapp is good. We'll tell you, Fred Grapp is the kind of
he's the race coach, the race trainer,
the race coach, the head of performance, or whatever you want to call him. As he told me, and you know, it's obvious this year they really built a real serious train for Demar. He won stages on Paris-Nice. He won stages on Dauphiné. And now the confidence is here. He's won classics now, big races. He's taken another dimension for sure. And really it meant a lot for the whole of the FDJ team.
There's more to him than he's certainly more than a pure sprinter, isn't he? We saw that on Monday with the finish in Longwy, that tough finish. And we saw Paris-Nice as well, where I think Gilbert, wasn't it?
He being absolutely
Paris-Nice. Or Julien Alaphilippe, sorry.
Oh,
it was Alaphilippe.
Yeah, you're right.
It was a rider who you would fancy to because he's big, you know, he's a big rider,
yeah,
but
big
he can get over these climbs, and he's strong, and he's shown that he can figure in pure flat stages and also in harder finishes. And I would say that he's a very strong contender for the green jersey. I should say before we crack on too much that we heard also from our main sponsor, Rafa, very grateful, of course, to them. And a reminder that throughout July, their theme is climbing, where Rafa Rising is what it's called. They're running a little competition to find out what kind of climber you are. Are you a pedal dancer, a data demon, or something else? Rafa is creating an illustrated online quiz that works out your climbing personality. Visit rafa.cc/climbers-quiz to take the quiz. That's rafa.cc/climbers-quiz. I wonder what kind of climber you are.
Well, I was going to say,
I know what kind of climber you are.
I fear I'd be a heffalump or something like that. A huffalump.
Not a very good one. It might come. No, I'm only joking. I'm only joking. Sorry.
Quite hurt.
You look upset.
I'm hurt more than upset. Anyway, let's go back to cyclists who are considerably better than me.
I gave you, we recreated the incident, didn't we, as we were coming back to the press room. I was on my Brompton, you were alongside me, Lionel, and I decided to just put the elbow on you a little bit.
You did, and well, yeah.
Did knock you over.
Even at that speed,
It was a hefty shot, and it was
very hard from you, Richard, knowing that Lionel was on the verge of Fringale all day, having missed breakfast and lunch. Well, anyway.
Well, that's almost the story of the day. I mean, let's put my missed breakfast and missed lunch to one side for the moment, and hear a little bit from FDJ's head of performance, Fred Grapp, about what it means to see Arnaud Démare win his first Tour de France stage.
Fred, a victory by Arnaud, I mean, means very much for you, I'm sure, today.
Yes, it was a great victory for the team. And this is the victory for all the teammates of the team, for the mechanics, for all the guys in the team, because since this winter, we make in place a train for Arnaud. And a great job all the winter, during all the months, for all the team. And today, I think, is very important for the team. It is a sort of symbol, because Arnaud is a great sprinter and great for the team. Great.
And you followed Arnaud from the ups and the downs of his career, and now it's a big up.
Yes, but it is normal. In a career, you are up, you are down. And it is a mean to constrict the guy. It is a mean to constrict a winner. It's not possible to have a linear career. Arnaud sometimes up, down, but now it's very, very, very up. It's great for us, yes.
Rich, just on Arnaud Démare, and Francois, I'd like your opinion on this. I do think that the clean, branding-free French champion's skin suit, I think it was, that Démare was wearing today, blue, white and red, running into the red shorts, but with no obvious prominent Francis Dujeux logo on the front, that really appeals to me as a sort of purist who remembers the sort of the old football shirts before sponsorship, and the champion's jerseys never used to be sullied by advertising way back in the day, did they? I think that's quite a nice... That's obviously Marc Madiot's...
Marc Madiot is the old school guy. I mean, he's kind of the keeper of the flame, you know. Is Marc Madiot is the guy who's in a way, you know, he embodies the heritage of old school cycling and old school French cycling, and he actually personally wore the tricolour jersey in the old days, and you could tell at the time he was really proud of that, and there was no sign of advertisement whatsoever, no team name on it, and I'm sure he asked his FDJ, you know, bosses, could we please avoid, you know, any... I mean, in a way, La Française des Jeux belongs to the French state. So, I mean, the red, white, and blue jersey is also the colours of the team. So, yeah. I mean, there's no real, you know, problem there, I think, no clash.
How will Madiot cope with his French champion wearing green tomorrow? He'll probably just sing La Marseillaise under his breath slightly at the start.
So, I mean, one little bit of unfinished business about Francis Dujeux that we didn't mention yesterday, because we didn't really clock it, was that Thibaut Pinot lost 3 minutes on that climb. I mean, we knew that Pinot wasn't coming here for GC. He's ridden the Giro and will target stage wins in the mountains. I don't think that was a big surprise. But let's return to the burning question.
Well, just on that.
Yeah, I talked to Pierre Roland this morning, and it was funny because Pierre Roland is in the same situation. He's not a GC contender. He says he's come to win a stage, and he told me, look at the GC. That there's me, there's Bauke Mollema, there's Thibaut Pinot, there's Pantano, there's Gianluca Brambilla. There's almost a dozen climbers already decided after four stages that they're going to lose 4 or 5 minutes to be on the safe side, to go for a stage win so if you look, you know, if you're in the gambling side of the sport, and if you look for winners in the second and third week, go down the GC and look at the climbers who've lost time, and obviously, well, and Roland in the end told me that's, in a way, there's far too many of us, you know, playing this little game. So there you are.
Tactical time loss. I mean, we do see it. Riders who aren't going to go for the general classification, but it will free them up for breaks. They won't be as eagerly chased. So perhaps Thibaut Pinot. I don't know him personally. I don't call him
your old friend, the Frenchman. Yeah, the French rider.
Maybe our old friend, the French rider, will target La Planche des Belles-Filles tomorrow.
Maybe, but let's return to the burning question. Peter Sagan, I mean, there aren't many precedents. I mentioned Mark Renshaw. Another case that came to my mind was Michel Polenta. He was thrown off the race in 1978 in the yellow jersey for trying to fiddle dope control.
I remember Tom Sayles on the tour 1 year. I couldn't tell.
Tom Sayles, of course.
Throwing a bead on.
Yeah.
That's correct, yep. And there was another one as well that came to me, Michael Rasmussen, who's in the press office
10 years ago.
10 years ago. Since he was really sent home by his team, wasn't he, in the end? So not many occasions when such a big rider has been thrown off the race, and it has been tended to be for doping-related offences. And I mean, I've said, I've said Daniel's said that he thought it was harsh. I must say, I think it is harsh. Do you think it's harsh, Lionel?
I think it's harsh, but I think it's just about the correct decision in terms of ensuring that in the future, you know, anything that crosses the line, and as Francois says, you can be at fault without necessarily intent. You know, that's the thing. I mean, we can all be experts. I think it looked worse the more times I watched it, and as you said, Francois, it's the elbow move that is the problem. Whether you could never prove that was an aggressive move, I would err on the side of caution and say that was a defensive move. That's Sagan anticipating contact and making himself bigger. And you know, I mean, I haven't sprinted like that, but I've ridden two abreast where, you know, they're suddenly coming together, and if you lean in and give a little bit of force to the rider, and as long as the other rider does the same thing, you can keep yourself both upright rather than, you know, knocking each other off. And I think there's these guys, their bike handling skills are absolutely extraordinary, especially Sagan. And I just don't think that you could say, you know, it was intentional, but you could say he was at fault. And while, yes, it is harsh, I think it, the fact that, you know, he is the world champion, it would have been much, much easier not to disqualify him than to disqualify him.
But there is a big but, and that raises a question for me. But maybe the sanction was harsh because it was Peter Sagan, and because the UCI race juries are very often accused of being too lenient or not applying the regulations in terms of skin suits or whatever.
Yeah, we saw some criticism of them over the Team Sky skin suits.
And so maybe Philippe Marin admitted in the skin suit debate, if there was a debate, but who admitted he didn't know what to do. You know, he didn't have the legal grounds, as he said, to act. Maybe there was this impression that if they were too lenient on Sagan, everybody would have said, it's because it was Peter Sagan. You didn't, you couldn't kick out the most, you know, fashionable, the most flamboyant rider of the bunch of the tour. And for Philippe Marin, I mean, obviously, he wanted to make a point. Peter Sagan or not Peter Sagan, you know, he did it. Well, he deserved to be kicked out, and we took our responsibility.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. A reminder that you can get 20% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. Enter the code CPOD20. That's CPOD20. You might have heard towards the end of the last bit, we've been joined by the Colombian Cycling Podcast, I think, just beside us. There it goes again. While we're here, mention Kilometre Zero. Every weekday morning, we are releasing episodes of Kilometre Zero. So we have actually released three so far, because we began on Friday. We did one on Dusseldorf, that was Daniel's one. We did one on ANC Halfords, that was your one, Lionel. And Orla Shinui this morning did one on Podium Girls. And we hear a real range of opinions on Podium Girls, and we hear from some Podium Girls themselves. Francois, you interviewed a couple of Podium Girls for us. It's really, really interesting, thought-provoking, and I say very balanced. I haven't done a Kilometre Zero yet, that means.
Well, your one will be tomorrow, won't it?
Indeed, well, on the environmental.
Oh, the green tour.
The green tour. Yeah, we've got a few more coming up. Looking forward to them. Thank you to Niederberg Wines for sponsoring Kilometre Zero.
Well, Rich, it was one of those days, wasn't it? It was a long stage, pleasant but unspectacular countryside. We were sort of joking, really, when we heard that one rider had got away, Guillaume van Kielsbroek, the Belgian rider who is the grandson of... Oh, you're going to have to tell me the year again, Rich. Was it
1963? 1963. I checked. I think it's three.
Oh, really?
Yep.
So van Kielsbroek was the is the grandson of Benoni Behaet, Belgian world champion, who won his world title in 1963 or 1964. I'm going to go with Francois. He's checked this out. So obviously a lot of cycling cycling heritage in his family. Rode for a number of years for Quickstep or Etics Quickstep. Won the 3 days of Depana a few years ago.
Has 1963.
Well done,
and
Google.
And he won a stage of the Tour de France in 1964.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's Benoni Behaet, the grandfather of van Kielsbroek. As we heard a little bit from him at the start, we may well hear more from him later on in the race in a kilometre zero. But
I remember his father being a rider as well.
Right.
And you mentioned the 1980s and 1990s style of racing, and to the point that I thought at first that his name was Guido van Kielsbroek.
Van Kielsbroek. I was speaking to our Belgian colleague Jan-Pieter de Vlieger from Het Nieuwsblad earlier about van Kielsbroek, because he rode for several years for Quickstep and moved down a division, as a few riders on Wanty Group have. Very tragic story about him, actually. A few years ago, he lost his girlfriend. She died in a car accident where they were both traveling in different cars, and she apparently died in his arms. Very sad, very sad story indeed. But yeah, he. I don't think it was exactly the plan for him to go out alone like that. Wanty Group are now the only team that have been in every break so far, aren't they? They're the breakaway kings. With him being on his own today, they have that record, but a long old day for him.
It was a long old day for him, and it was a long old day for anyone watching the Tour de France today, because other than the scenery, and unless you're a big, big fan of the Wanty Group Goubert jersey, there wasn't an awful lot else to look at. And like we said, this was curious at the finish that no one took up the chase, no one really put together a lead out. We're going to have to do a bit of asking around to see why that. I did ask a couple of people after Marcel Kittel's win, asked Brian Holm whether this was a trend we might see, and he sort of shrugged it off a little bit. But I think there's something going
on
there. The sprint trains, maybe, you know, it's too much effort for not enough reward when there's a lot of potential sprinters. But before the crashes and the disqualification of Peter Sagan, we could have been scratching around a bit today. I made some notes of other things that have happened today. Andy and Frank Schleck were at the start village this morning doing a lot of media interviews. We started in Luxembourg this morning, so that explains why they were both there. And I saw Andy Schleck looking fit and well, and, you know, a healthy, normal-looking weight for a man in his early 30s. But it did make me think, crikey, how thin and skeletal they look. Because my instinct was, initially, on seeing him, was, blimey, Andy Schleck's bulked up a bit. But he's, you know, that just...
He's always liked his beer as well. So, you know, maybe it can account for a sudden surge in weight or something.
Sticking with the eating and drinking, which I saw Warren Barguil and Ramon Sinkelman of Sunweb queuing up in the village to get a waffle on a stick. I also had a waffle on a stick. I had the Nutella on mine. They didn't. That was my breakfast, because we had no breakfast at our Airbnb. And then when we got to the press room here, all the sandwiches had gone. So my lunch was a banana and a cold coffee-flavoured eclair. So not a good day on the food front. Hoping for better this evening, Francois. You've booked the restaurant tonight, so that will hopefully work out well. And we also saw Dag Otto Lauritsen at the petrol station on the auto route, and I said hello and reminded him that we'd made a kilometre zero this time last year about the forces of politics in cycling, because he rode the Tour de Trump back in the early 90s, and he said in that podcast there's no way Trump's going to win the election. So I congratulated him on his political analysis.
Get any tips for the tour from him? He's certainly the most tanned man in cycling, and we were remembering the winner 30 years ago of a stage at Luzard Den, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was there, and it was a funny stage, if I dare say, because at the time, no internet, no mobile phones, no, well, the technology was not exactly the same, and we had to wait until the final 2K kilometers when we were in the press room or even at the finish line to know who had won, because that day was so much fog on the last climb, yeah, that and the helicopters and planes were not flying, that nobody actually knew who was in the lead. And so as I told a Norwegian journalist once, you know, I was interviewed on that stage, and I told him, well, you know, the first ever victory by a Norwegian on Tour de France, there's no images of that, because, you know, it just emerged from nowhere and won the stage.
If a Norwegian wins a stage of the Tour de France and nobody's around to see it, has he won a stage? Norwegian would. I don't know where I'm going with that. I also spoke to Aymar Zubeldi at the start today. He was a late call-up after his teammate Andre Cardoso tested positive for EPO, Trek Segafredo rider. Zubeldi is a rider we talk about a lot. He ghosts into the top 10.
This year he's ghosted into the Tour. This is peak Zubeldi.
It is peak Zubeldi. But he's also one of the oldest riders in the race. And when riders are called up last minute like that, you often get the impression they're a bit annoyed. It's not really the way you'd like to prepare for the Tour, but ever the pro, he was delighted to be here and was very annoyed in the first place not to make the final nine. So he was, obviously, the circumstances were extremely unfortunate, and it'd be good to talk to the team about that case. I saw Luca Guercellina at the finish today, but he was a bit busy with John Degenkolb taking him off to have his wounds inspected, because he also came down in the crash with Ben Swift. I think they're both okay. But, yeah, we will ask him about that. But, Zubeldi is here, and he's here to help Alberto Contador.
My little anecdote, this morning I went to talk to Pierre Latour, who is the white jersey holder, and I heard about it, but I asked him the question. You know, he gave names to his legs. One is called, I wanted to know which was which. So you'd be glad to know, if you see Pierre Latour doing well on TV, his left leg is called Brigitte, like Brigitte Bardot, Brigitte, and his right leg is called Bernadette.
Is there a reason for this?
Apparently, it's just a trick he used in training to motivate himself, and so he was going, you know, after his legs, saying, "Go on, Brigitte, go on, Bernadette, go on, Brigitte, go on, Bernadette," and it was the way for him to ride faster.
Very odd, isn't it?
Two challenges for me: to come up with my climbing style name and also rename my legs.
Good help, you never know.
What might we call your legs, Lionel?
Well, Pete and Mark, for instance, or Chris and Geraint. Or
I think that's flattering my legs somewhat. I was thinking weak and weaker.
I call mine strong and stable, Lionel. Although neither at the moment, unfortunately. We're taking nominations for Pedler de Charme. Still a lot of, well, in fact, we had a very amusing email today. I think I'll read out a little bit of it. I hope he doesn't mind me mentioning his name, Chuck Wooldridge from America. He writes, "I realise that you were practically begging on today's podcast for nominations other than Taylor Finney, but I just don't think you can top the interview in which he, one, drops a Murakami reference, two, describes a nude hotel meeting with Charlie Wigelius, and three, gives love to a violin player who was killing it. We are in full Chiro territory, wholly apart from the great stories about his parents, his recovery from injury, and his team. Give him the T-shirt." He says he's also just signed up as a friend of the podcast for 2015, 16, and 17. This chap, and I've been binge listening. I may never accomplish anything else, he says. Thanks for that, Chuck. We appreciate correspondence like that. Anyone can email us at contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
Well, this guy deserves a T-shirt.
Well, he deserves a T-shirt, but the question is, does Taylor Finney deserve a T-shirt? There are, Joan Ofredo is another one who's earning nominations. And today's Breakaway King as well. So send your nominations to us by any means. Email, Twitter, cycling_podcast, Facebook, letter.
Yeah, carrier pigeon.
Whatever, yeah.
Anyway, I've got a slight headache through being hungry.
Yeah.
So I think that's the end of this podcast.
Let's go. Let's go to the next restaurant.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's leave it there. Thank you very much. We've got a big day tomorrow. We would have looked ahead to that, but La Planche des Belles Filles tomorrow, big climb. Yeah. Good day again, Francois. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.